You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
You're not Matt.
I am not. You are Bill, but I'm not Matt. I'm Aria Cohen-Wade, and you are Bill Scherer.
You are coming from another corner of the bloggingheads.tv universe.
Yes, I am the host of Culturally Determined on Blogging Heads and a former executive editor at the site. And when I heard that, you know, Matt was having a was going on vacation for a week, I volunteered to come on because I, you know, I'm a longtime DMZ fan. We could blog even, you know, when it was previous incarnation. So it's an honor to be on. And also, I have some questions of my own sort that I wanted to talk to you about on my show. So this is a, sort of a crossover episode in some respects.
So this was like a 10-year project to reach this pinnacle where you actually are on the DMZ?
Yes. It's, hoping someday just to you know, touch the hem of the garment of,
you know, this place launches careers, you know, not my own, but we've had big people come through the DMZ. So
it's true.
You know, this could be the tipping point for you.
Well, I'm, you know, open to offers and my DMs are open.
Well, for folks who don't know about Culturally Determined, why don't you tell people a little bit about that show?
It is another podcast on Blogging Heads, ostensibly about culture, but I do cover some of the intersection between culture and politics. And I've been talking a lot about how Trump has affected the culture and how we're going to move forward now that Trump is off the scene, perhaps forever, perhaps not. And maybe we'll talk about that. But yeah, so it's going from talking about, you know, the latest Marvel movie or stuff like that to a recent episode. I interviewed a woman who wrote about Hannah Arendt and how Hannah Arendt's legacy was misused during the Trump administration. So high and low and stuff in between.
That's like a much smarter show than what we do here. So you're going to really have to dumb it down, you know, for our people. So, you know, yesterday was the Ohio special election primaries, and there's a lot of attention on the Democratic primary in Ohio 11, but there was a primary in Ohio 15 where the Trump-endorsed candidate won. And this is after a top two special election in Texas where there were two Republicans and the Trump-endorsed candidate did not win. So for someone who's keeping a close eye on Trump's influence in the Republican Party, how do you synthesize all that?
Yeah, it's interesting. And so, you know, Trump likes to win and he likes to pick winners. And so I assume he is somewhat careful with who he endorses, but also he is, you know, if you suck up to him and kiss his ass, then he'll, you know, be nice to you. And so it seems like there's also ways just to, or if you sort of imitate his style, he pays attention to you that way. So it's uncertain. He's definitely not the kingmaker at this point. But at the same time, he isn't powerless and he's not like in exile and all alone. I wasn't paying really any attention to either of the Ohio races, but it seemed like, you know, there were five or so candidates in the Republican field and the winner got about 30%. So if there's, you know, a crowded field and everyone else got about like 13 or 15%. So if there's a crowded field and they're all sort of equally GOP, you know, losers or whatever, or winners, then if Trump anoints one, you know, and he gets you 15-20% of the vote, then that seems like enough to put someone over the top. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that sounds right. A lot of primaries are crowded, and a Trump endorsement with a Republican-only electorate would be a good way to get the plurality that you need to be the nominee. But it raises a very big question whether that's helpful to the Republican Party in the general election. So what you had in Texas was a top two. So you had a primary that everybody got to be in, regardless of party affiliation. And the two highest vote getters moved on to the general, and they were both Republicans. But it's not just Republicans that can vote in the general election. So Democrats and independents could be there, and Trump's endorsement didn't carry his candidate Susan Wright, if I remember correctly, didn't carry her far enough. So if Trump's power is limited to a plurality of the Republican base, that's not necessarily going to help Republicans in the midterm. I mean, look, midterms, as we've talked about before, historically speaking, are very, 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 very good for the out party, for the opposition party. But if Democrats are going to do the unusual, not unprecedented, but unusual achievement of gaining seats, and I think they need to, they can barely lose anything to keep the House, and they can't lose literally anything to keep the Senate. Picking bad candidates in tough races because you have a quote unquote kingmaker who's not a great kingmaker. That's way for Democrats to pull this out.
Yeah. And you know, I assume while Trump does have sort of a sense of, you know, he has a connection to the GOP base that is unique, and there's various reasons for that. You know, he watches Fox News instead of just appearing on Fox News. So he sort of understands. I think he also believes what happens on Fox News is true. So he is sort of in a similar mindset as a GOP based voter. And so he can sort of, you know, he sees someone go on there and he can be like, this is my kind of person. And that may be a good reflection of, you know, free floating GOP sentiment. But also, yeah, just the people who kiss up to him or imitate him or something. Though, you know, he might just swing behind them because he has no, it's not like he really has like a policy agenda that he's looking to implement. It's, you know, he just likes winners and attention. And at least that's my read on where he's at right now.
I'm not fully convinced that Trump is all that thoughtful with his picks, that, and that he is looking to pick winners. I don't think he's looking to like run in front of the parade. I mean, it seems like he's much more vulnerable to the person who kisses up the most. Who's the craziest?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's a little inconsistent. Like, you know, Susan Wright in Texas wasn't the craziest person. It was just the person who was the widow of the person who died. And maybe that seemed like the safe thing to do. So it's hard to put like a fully rational, consistent analysis on it. But yeah. I don't get the sense that he is being all that clever and canny with it. And what really boggles my mind is why the rest of the party tolerates that. You have a guy leading who is the de facto leader of the party, who clearly has more influence in the party than anybody else. So even if it's not total, it is more than anybody else. And he doesn't make decisions that put the party's interests first. Why would you just acquiesce to that?
Yeah, I am similarly befuddled by that, and maybe if Matt were here, he could give an explanation from the conservative perspective. I mean, yeah, Trump is not a long-term strategic thinker. Probably most people would agree with that. And he, you know, acts on instinct and shoots from the hip. And yeah, and you know, the fact, and yeah, his interests do not really always align with the GOP at large. And maybe if he does want to run again in 2024, maybe a unified Democratic Congress to run against would be more in his strategic interest. So who even knows if he wants to help, if it's ultimately in his interest for them, you know, for the Republicans to win the House in 2022, who even knows? But yeah, does he even think that way? I mean, the fact that, you know, the GOP had a chance to put the kibosh on Trump if they had voted to convict him at impeachment. And I almost thought that, you know, Mitch McConnell, the, you know, cold-eyed cynic, would just say, "Okay, we're cutting this guy loose. He's too insane, and we're going to be done with him." And he decided not to do that. So that's his. You know, he understands his interests better than I understand his interests. But they could have disempowered Trump a lot more if they had just all jumped together and been like, "Screw this guy. He is horrible." But they didn't. They kept him alive, and that has sort of been a theme throughout the way the GOP has treated Trump, as being like, "Oh, we don't need to actually, you know, slit his throat now. He's damaged enough, et cetera, et cetera." And then he'll, you know, he's unkillable otherwise. So,
but you believe, you told me beforehand that you believe Trump is not going to run for president again in 2024.
If I had to bet, I would say that. I guess that's against conventional wisdom at this point, but you know, what does he, well, I, you know, I had this crackpot theory that he didn't even want to really run for president to begin with. He just sort of had this idea to get attention and be on TV and sell hats and build his brand. And then it was sort of a, you know, the producer's theory, as it came to be known, it was a catastrophic success. And, you know, he was vaulted into the presidency without really wanting to do it. He, of course, likes being the number one person in the world and getting all the attention and being on TV all the time and having people talk about him. But does he, you know, does he have a policy agenda? If you had asked me 2016, it would have been he would have built the wall. Mexico wouldn't have paid for it, but like he really would have concentrated on building that wall. But he didn't. He got, you know, Paul Ryan convinced him that a tax cut and Obamacare repeal were the first things to do. And since he was so befuddled and didn't know, you know, he was easily hoodwinked by outside policy entrepreneurs. And so what does, you know, it's not like he has some great plan that he wants to do again. He would only do it if he really wants to return to the power and the attention. And you have to think like, okay, he's 74 now, I think, 3 more years. He's not going to get any better in terms of mental clarity and like, you know, emotional stability. And you know, he could be indicted by New York State. He could be indicted by the feds. You know, who knows? There's going to be a lot of things. A lot of his people are looking very closely at his assets and try, you know, and he, I think really he wants, most of all, he wants the scam to continue. He wants people to keep talking about him. He's perfectly happy living at various golf courses he owns around the country. And maybe even he'll flee to Scotland or something. But I don't think he really wants to go through it all again. He can keep on doing the rallies without running for president. He can tease. He can play the media the way he often does. But does he really want to go through all the, you know, work of running again and possibly losing again?
So basically, you think his laziness will outweigh his massive addiction to attention.
Right. I mean, he can still get the attention. He's getting attention the way no previous, you know, ex-president ever has. So he can still command some attention. He can call up Fox News and get a phone interview whenever he wants. But he doesn't, like, did he enjoy the actual work of the presidency? He had a lot of meetings. He couldn't go golfing as much as he wanted to, you know.
I think he found a way. He found a way to golf. He got in there.
I mean, plenty more golfing. When you live on a golf course, like you can take it, get in 2 rounds a day. So that lifestyle certainly seems a lot, you know, more suited to the Trump that we know right now than actually governing again, which he never really seemed to enjoy, or implementing a policy agenda, which he never really had to begin with.
Well, what I think is tough about this analysis, and because you know, it is ultimately a mind reading exercise, which is always, you know, very challenging.
And his mind is unique in human history, so
right. But I do think there is that tension between his narcissism and his laziness.
Yeah.
But over the course of the past 6 years, the part of him that wants to be the center of attention in the most, you know, exponential way in human history has outweighed everything else. Everyone who thought, oh, he's not serious, he's not going to really run, oh, he's not going to run seriously, oh, he's going to drop out, oh, he's going to resign, oh, he's going to find the escape hatch. That never happened. It was always right. more. He could never even accept a slight bump up in the polls without doing something outrageous that was, you know, politically irrational, but serve the need to be in the front page all the time. I mean, you're literally president of the United States. You're already the most powerful person in the world, and you can't go 24 hours without being literally on page one all the time. Like that's a level of narcissistic depravity that we've never seen before.
Yes.
And that seemed to really outweigh everything else. And what I think is hard to get your arms around now is how do you assess his post-presidential behavior? To be frank, he's not as omnipresent as I thought he would be. I mean, he's doing some things, but it seems more sporadic, his attempt to draw attention to himself. There's a rally here and a rally there, does a Fox thing here, does a I guess OAN or Newsmax. I don't even pay that close attention. So
the fact that that Twitter kicked him off really hurt his ability to keep on injecting himself into.
But it shouldn't have. He could have been more creative.
Well, the thing is, he's not. He has certain geniuses in certain areas, but he's not like actually smart in all areas or even most. And so he's good at manipulating the media, and he took advantage of Twitter, where media people are spending all their time, such that he would say something crazy and everyone would cover it. Oh, it turns out if he just says the crazy thing and releases it as like a press statement with letterhead, oh, it turns out we don't really need to pay that much attention to him, especially when he doesn't.
I think you could have crazy enough press statements that would generate lots of news coverage without doing the extra bit of tweeting it yourself. I don't think Twitter is that magical. I mean, Twitter is, it's easy to drop, a 200 character statement and do 20 of them a day, but he has been able to generate press for himself before the age of the internet. This is like a doesn't know how to manipulate media.
If he wanted
to say crazy stuff about Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, be a little racist, be a little sexist, take more pot shots at fellow Republicans. I mean, Republican action is great for news coverage. There is more he could be doing. So I don't think he's maxing out on his ability to generate media coverage. But at the same time, he's not just playing golf either. He is involved in Republican primaries. He is trying to put his thumb on the scale. And why would you do that if you didn't have an interest in your own political future? So I think it's hard to synthesize all the data points and come out with a clear expectation what he's going to do next.
That all makes sense to me. And I think narcissism versus laziness is the key, thing we need to think about. And I think the laziness will win out because his narcissism can be satisfied. He can get on OAN or Newsmax whenever he wants. And, his sycophants are watching that. And so that's not as good as getting on Fox News or whatever, but it's still like him on TV and he can watch it on TiVo later and people are talking about him. So I just think, certainly his life at Mar-a-Lago, where every time he goes to dinner, everyone stands up and claps for him and, says like, we still think you're the president, sir. And, kisses his ass. Like that satisfies a lot of the narcissism, stuff. I think it's seemingly it's like a black hole and inexhaustible.
To me, the best argument that he wouldn't run is that he knows in the back of his mind that he would lose again, that it would be a true humiliation, and it's better to maintain the current fiction, at least amongst his people, that he really won and it was stolen from him. I mean, you could also argue that he would just maintain that same storyline if he lost twice. More proof the deep state is against me.
And this sort of played out in the Georgia special election. If he's convinced his hardcore fans that, the Chinese government is actually running U.S. elections, then what's the point of even showing up? But he also has his hardcore fans where, like, if he doesn't rally them, they're not paying attention to politics, so they don't show up. So it's sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing. I think that's part of why, both Democrats eked out slim victories in Georgia is – he'd been talking about the stolen election for 2 months. So there were some percentage of 1 or 2% of the GOP base who were like, the deep state is running this. Why even go vote? What's the point? It's all a sham. And then the fact that he was kind of equivocal about it. So, the GOP is like stuck with him as long as he's still alive. And it's unclear if that ultimately helps or hurts like the GOP's interests because, his base is, he's irrational to a large extent, and then the base like follows what he says. So if he goes around doing rallies, that pisses off plenty of people in the middle and energizes Democrats. And if he doesn't do the rallies and just golfs, then there's people who aren't on his base who aren't activated. So I don't know, what is best for the GOP. I can't say.
And there's the other element here is that people are concerned that Republicans will just steal the election for him. That they're putting people in place to ignore actual vote results and subvert our democracy. And, I don't want to be sanguine about that because there's clearly, machinations that are occurring. I do think it is harder to pull off than it appears. And it's not at all clear to me that there would be enough people positioned in enough of the key swing states for Trump to actually make that work. George is the one that we are focused the most on. It's a very tight purple state, and they're already gearing up to, you know, get rid of a whole bunch of people in Fulton County. I don't want to act as if like nothing to see here.
Right.
But one thing that I do point out, and I have pointed out in past articles, is there is a law on the books that if you tamper with an election, if you do anything to manipulate the vote count, and this is whether you're an elected official or not, that's up to 5 years in prison. Now, people rightly point out they want to create laws in these states that, you know, like vote purging, for example, that make it legal. So it wouldn't violate that federal law. But I think it's just hard. I mean, you still have to keep in the back of your mind that you are vulnerable to that law if you step out of bounds.
This is like a secretary of state, you know, in a swing state who decides to like say, oh, the election's canceled and actually Donald Trump has won. You know, that person is subject to arrest and prosecution.
I mean, if the Georgia secretary of state listened to Trump and went and found 11,000 votes, he would have violated federal law and be subject to 5 years in prison. Now, you could argue, well, if no one knows about it, if no one leaked the phone calls and they kept the tight conspiracy.
Or if that leads to Trump winning again, then he tells his FBI director, you know, or his Justice Department, the guy who's running the Justice Department for him, you know, let's just put this one off for a little bit. You can imagine, I mean, there's sort of nightmare scenarios. And certainly, I mean, it's this weird paradox where, you know, Trump certainly pushed things farther and more people went along with him than I would have thought possible 5 years ago. At the same time, like his attempt at, like, you know, the storming of the Capitol, certainly not something I would have predicted even 3 months before. And that took most people by surprise. At the same time, it was a sort of like farcical joke attempt at whatever. And ultimately, like, things just proceeded as they would have otherwise. So it's sort of like, Trump has shown how reliant on norms the system is and how far someone can push it, and that a lot of people will bow to him and go along with his nonsense. But also, like, him and Giuliani and Mike Lindell and Lynn Wood, like, this was not the crack team that was actually going to overturn an election and, like, start American fascism.
Well, I think
people were all, like, you know, elderly bozos in the end. But, like, you could imagine some sort of canny American Machiavel actually like pulling this off. It is all, a lot of it is reliant on norms and not codified law. So like it, I don't know. It's the system is more messed up than I would have thought it was 5 years ago.
But it's not just that, you know, Trump, Giuliani, et cetera, are clowns. You know, in pretty much every case, somebody talked, somebody leaked, somebody raised their hand and said, this isn't right. Like, you need a lot of people. You need a lot of people in the right positions, willing to hide the ball, keep their mouth shut, and stay on message to pull off a conspiracy of this magnitude. And the person who gets the text that tells them to manufacture this vote count here to make it look good, and you're holding down your phone, you're saying, now the evidence is in my hand, that if someone finds this out, I'm going to jail. Somebody tends to be the guy that says, that's not going to be me. So I just think, I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm not saying everyone should just like go about their daily lives and not worry about these things. But I do think it's a lot harder to pull off than it appears. And I don't think if you're Donald Trump, you would make the decision to run thinking, oh, the fix is in and I'm sure to win. There's no way this could go wrong.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. And, you know, ultimately, like, if let's say Trump had after on like January 20th said, I'm not leaving, like, you can't pull me out of here. You know, someone would have come, like the military, the National Guard or something, and removed him forcibly. Mm-hmm. And so like ultimately the people with the guns and the tanks, which you would think would step in, even, you know, if there was an attempt to steal or something. And I mentioned this episode that hasn't posted yet that I taped with a woman who wrote an essay about Hannah Arendt. And, you know, she noted, like, there was this famous quote about how, like, the ideal subject of totalitarianism, doesn't know the difference between truth and fiction, and that people dug up from Arendt and said, like, this is, you know, this is Trump's America. But, you know, the press was, you know, for totalitarianism to happen, the state has to basically take over the press and get their lie out consistently, whereas the press from day one was anti-Trump, and people were leaking nonstop from within the White House. And I'm sure there's plenty of stuff that's still going to come out, but, like, it wasn't, we weren't living in this altered reality of, you know, Stalin's Russia or something. Like, the press continued to function, and that was, you know, one reason that American fascism wasn't, you know, incipient in the past 4 years. Like, it just, what the setup wasn't right for it, and maybe never would be in the American system. But at the same time, I think Trump showed that, like, the system is more rickety and has more possible fail points than, you know, I would have once thought.
Let me shift gears, because there's another big story yesterday, which was the New York Attorney General's report chronicling Governor Andrew Cuomo's sexual harassment. Tons of cooperation, plenty of instances. And now you're hearing, you know, nearly almost every Democrat saying you should resign, and some talking about impeachment. There is the Ralph Northam model, which is to ignore all that and ride it out, let the news eventually fade, perhaps sign some legislation to appease progressives. You can't call Ralph Northam a racist if he's signing racial justice legislation. At least you can't do it as easily. Mm-hmm. Can Andrew Cuomo pull off the same trick? And I mean, this presumably is up to New York legislators. Can he say to them, hey, you want this bill or that bill? I'll get that done for you. We can ride this out together. You don't need to impeach me. Who's that going to help?
Right.
Do you think Cuomo has cards to play here?
You know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, Cuomo is sort of like Trump in some strong ways, except he's like smarter and cannier and, you know, more of a Machiavelli type, and has really, like, you know, played people inside and knows how to effectuate his will, at least legislatively, in a way Trump was never able to. And of course, you know, like, but, and yeah, he, so, but he also sort of has this, like, narcissistic, possibly sociopathic tendency. Like, he thinks he's the indispensable man and totally great and can solve everything and so on and so forth. So I don't think he's going to resign, because he's too much of a narcissist to resign. And, but then, you know, there's, or like, to kind of, well, I mean, impeachment could happen. I don't know. I mean, the other thing is, like, it seems like almost everyone who has had contact with him and isn't, like, in his inner circle doesn't like him, and they'd be happy to get rid of him. It's sort of similar to the Trump thing. Like, they're just going to say, okay, you've gone one step too far. Goodbye, Andrew. We don't want to deal with you anymore, because he's such an asshole, basically. He treats everyone like shit. And, you know, in addition to sexually harassing women, like, you know, calls up people and screams at them on the phone, and yeah, just acts like a total jerk to everyone. And so he's used up all his chits. I mean, the other thing is, it's his third term, and he was talking about possibly running for a fourth. That's a lot. Like, you sort of, people get sick of you after a certain point, and they're like, let's try something new. So even running for a fourth, I mean, Pataki did four terms, but that was sort of because 9/11.
Pataki,
like,
got the four. I thought Pataki was three.
Maybe I'm wrong about that. I thought Pataki did get the four, or did he at least run for four? But, yeah, I mean, four terms, that's a long time.
I mean, Mario Cuomo tried for four and he got beat by Pataki.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. And so, yeah, people are just sort of, I think, so, and my background in relation to Cuomo is that I lived in central and western New York for a dozen years, and so I was a New York State voter, but outside the traditional, like, media spheres of Albany and New York, where most observers of New York politics live. And plenty of people liked him out there. He kept property taxes low, you know, moved progressive in some ways, like in gay marriage and the SAFE Act, which was the gun legislation passed after the Sandy Hook massacre. And you would leave you know, I lived in Rochester, you would leave the Rochester metro area and you'd see all these signs, Governor Cuomo repealed the SAFE Act. So he was taking a risk with doing something like that against, you know, rural and suburban areas where hunting was very important and there was strong opposition to that. So he did take some, you know, he did some strong progressive things. And I also, you know, like to troll my leftist friends by noting that when he ran against, when Cynthia Nixon challenged him, he won all five boroughs comfortably. And it wasn't real, you know, won like 65%. But so he has this strong base of support. He really understands what he can accomplish and what he can't, and does play everyone with this Machiavellian style, and was, you know, engineered like this dissident faction so that he like controlled the legislature. And, but people, I think people basically are sick of him and are fed up with his bullshit at this point. So I don't think he can say like, okay, we're going to do like, we're going to legalize marijuana and like, I'll give that to you. Or what else? I don't know what other things he can pull out of, tricks he can pull out of his sleeve at this point. So I don't know. I'm stuck between thinking he's too much of a narcissist to resign, but if everyone is really like, this guy has finally gone too far, then they will just impeach him. And then maybe he'll resign before he gets impeached, because that would be too much of a black mark. Because when's the last New York State governor that got impeached? Has that ever happened? I have no idea.
I think there's very few governors at all who have actually been impeached and convicted. I'd have to go back and check, but I think it's very, very rare if it's ever happened. Just Pataki had three terms. I think he thought about a fourth and then begged off. Okay. You mentioned that, it reminds me of a story from my college days, if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
But so this always stuck in my head. I had a politics class, like a 200 level class. It was one of like, if you were a politics major, like you, almost everybody did this class. And it was basically a big negotiation workshop. And everyone had to do a negotiation role play during the class. And it could be with another student or it could be with the professor. And there was one guy, and it was a guy who, you know, there's always that one guy on campus who everyone who would say he's going to run for president someday. He definitely thought very highly of himself. And he did a role play with the professor, and the student was portraying LBJ and the professor was portraying a senator. It was this funny, socially awkward conversation where they seem to be talking about nothing much of all of importance. They're just having like a chit chat and everyone in the class is watching like, what's actually happening? What's actually being negotiated here? And then finally, LBJ gets up to leave and says, hey, thanks for your support on this bill of mine. I really appreciate it. And the professor played the senator saying, yeah, I saw that in the paper, but I didn't say I was supporting that bill. I don't know how that got in there. I actually haven't made up my mind on that yet. And then the negotiation started, and LBJ loses. The senator doesn't budge. And then we learn afterwards, that the premise was that LBJ planted the story to box in the senator, mm-hmm. and it failed. And, you know, when we're discussing it, the professor was like, well, why did you do that? And he was like, well, you know, I've always, you know, admired LBJ. He was a guy that did whatever it took, twisted every arm, you know, to get things done. And I was trying to, you know, model that. And the professor said, there's two things you got to know about LBJ. He got run out of town and he died a broken man. So that always stuck in the back of my head. And you know, I think, you know, Andrew Cuomo was certainly in that kind of position where he probably has no true friends. No one is eager to have his back when he is in trouble.
Right.
Having said that, I mean, what he would need to survive, I mean, I agree with you, he's not going to willingly resign. He'd only resign if his hand was truly forced. If you had like a Nixon moment where the senators come in and say, look, you're going to get impeached, you're going to get convicted, so you got no choice, or you might as well walk out with a shred of dignity.
Yeah. I wondered if like the inner circle staff starts resigning because it's just too embarrassing that, and he's left with no one, like if, you know, the chief of staff resigns or whatever, then that maybe could get through to him that like your goose is cooked.
I mean, I think the votes have to be there. Someone has to tell him that he believes and say, look, we've counted the votes and you will lose. So there's no point.
Mm-hmm.
If, and this is obviously an if Cuomo's poll numbers hold, then maybe you won't get enough state legislatures willing to impeach and convict. Maybe they'd say, hey, this is not a good vote for me to take, and I'm better off trying to approach the governor and see what he will do for me. What legislation that I get passed that will be impressive to my constituents. We know that right. When the scandal first hit, that I mean, Cuomo's numbers, they came down, but not down enough to make him truly vulnerable. I grew up in New York. I grew up in New York in the '80s, in the Reagan days. So obviously, you know, people's political stability is not the same now as they were back then. But there's still a part of me that feels like this is not a culturally enlightened place. There's a lot of sexist machismo. There's a lot of people that would say, yeah, you know, he touches everybody. Yeah, you know, you kiss here, kiss there. Yeah, he's a little flirty. Yeah, people are flirty. What's the big deal?
Was basically his defense, this thing. I actually didn't see it, but I saw people. He put together this, like, slideshow of he kisses everyone. He embraces everyone. He calls everyone Bella, and you know, it's just his Italian thing. I don't know if he said that explicitly, but he's like playing on this idea of like, oh, he's Italian, what can he do? So maybe that'll work, but it sort of seems like that could have maybe worked in 1993, but like things have changed kind of like post Me Too,
you know.
And also,
I think this is damaged. How much have they actually changed?
I feel like they have changed enough that people are like, come on, this is bullshit. But someone put together that slideshow for him, and that was. They decided their best play. He's a smart guy. At the same time, so he had this spike during the pandemic, no pun intended, for seeming to know what he was talking about, it being in control, and the Cuomo sexual thing happened. And then it comes out like, oh, he was actually screwing up and sending, you know, people who are ill back into nursing homes and probably caused, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of additional deaths that were undercounted. And so I feel like there's people who were once like, Cuomo stands within New York State who were suddenly, you know, a strange new respect for Andrew Cuomo a year and a half ago. And now they're looking back saying, oh, wait, maybe he is not such a great guy and really did screw up in some big ways into sort of a psychopath who was, you know, he's like writing a book about how great he was at the same time he was sort of screwing up this huge, you know, challenge. So I don't know. Yeah, there are still people in suburban parts of New York State, Long Island and Staten Island and Westchester County and other places in upstate and Western New York who are probably like, oh, yeah, I'll kiss my secretary or something. And that doesn't mean anything. But when you add in all this other stuff of just like, he's been in office for, you know, 13 years, people are sick of him. The nursing home stuff, he alienates everyone he gets in contact with. It may just be like, people are like, okay, let's just let this nice lady, Kathy Hochul, you know, from outside Buffalo. Let's let her serve out the rest of the term.
And well, yeah, I mean, most politicians have shelf lives, and pushing for three terms is always pushing your luck. And it's like pushing for four is really pushing your luck. And yeah. Seems like you want to one up the old man and get to four. Right. But you know,
I mean the like Oedipal stuff, the whole, you're like, did you even see this news item? It sort of passed with little notice, but the stuff about the bridge lights. Okay, Cuomo had this plan to encourage tourism and by putting LED lights on all of the iconic New York State bridges. And I guess other places in the world have done something like this. And then, you know, and then you can do sort of like light shows because it's LEDs. So you can do these elaborate light shows on the bridges and it looks pretty. And people will like come and watch the light shows and maybe there's music or something. So he had this plan that all the bridges, including the bridge that he built and named after his father, would have these lights installed on them. And it turns out that this is like a huge boondoggle and like $100 million worth of lights are still sitting in warehouses somewhere, mm-hmm. never used because the whole thing was impractical to begin with. And so that's the kind of thing that like in normal times that like, you know, Lightgate could take down, you know, maybe the cousin is the light manufacturer or something, or maybe it's just this huge, just his ego kind of thing is like, all right, we'll make the bridges shine, you know, that kind of thing. Who knows? But like that sort of stuff, you know, more and more things are just like, oh, it seemed like he knew what he was doing, but actually it was this huge screw up or boondoggle or classic state corruption kind of thing happening. Like that is going to keep on coming up. And so, yeah, there's all these lights in the warehouse somewhere. They can't put them on the bridges. And that is sort of an Andrew Cuomo legacy of unused LED lights.
I mean, that's why, you know, I think running for a fourth term is very rarely worth the risk. You know, even the best politicians, you got to make tough decisions. You got to compromise. You got to pick one faction over another. Like, you eventually, you know, step on toes, and that's why you should get out when the getting's good. So, you know, probably the best case scenario for Cuomo is that he goes to these legislatures and says, look, I'm not going to run again. All right. I'm not going to run again, but keep me around. I'll get this for you. I'll get that for you. You know, we all will walk out of here with our dignity intact. We'll do some nice things for people. But I do think his poll numbers have to stay up well enough for that to be a reasonable thing for a legislature to accept and not be politically damaging for themselves back.
Right. Right. But then if you think that there's ongoing investigations into the nursing home thing, into the book contract, that he was maybe like having his staff write this book for him while they should have been working on the COVID crisis in, you know, spring and summer 2020. And you know, let's say, you know, why doesn't maybe Tish James will launch an investigation into Lightgate, and, you know, we're going to have Lightgate hearings. And so there's just all these things bubbling up from the past that just saying like, okay, you know, I will go off into the good night and not cause as much, you know, mischief as I used to, that option may not exist anyway.
Let's shift gears again. So I do want to cover a couple more things before we should sign off. We should talk about Ohio 11 and the Chantel Brown victory over Nina Turner. I could be mistaken here. I don't think Brown ever led in a poll. Now, I don't think it was that heavily polled. Mm-hmm. And a lot of polls we saw were internal polls that are getting leaked, which are obviously not the greatest, you know, poll numbers. But there was signs that that Brown was picking up steam, but there never was a full sense that she had really taken control of the race. And yet she won with a decent cushion. I think it was 6 points last I checked. And it just strikes me. I was on this. I was someone who was always skeptical that the socialist left was making huge inroads into the party. Not that they were making inroads. But, you know, from the literal day when AOC won her primary, I had a piece in Politico saying, you know, the revolution has not arrived. You know, just because you won a low turnout election in one of the deepest districts of the country doesn't mean this is sweeping the nation. And of course, I've always gotten guff from taking that view, but
right.
We've not seen this replicated in most places. There are some places, you know, there is Jamal Bowman, there is Cori Bush, there is Mondaire Jones, who was a bit more of a Warrenite than a Bernieite, but still is being squad-esque as a congressperson. There's still lots of examples of the establishment carrying the day, particularly in places that are not so deep blue. Now, this, of course, is Cleveland. It's not a purple area, but it is majority African American, and there we've had data. Again, I've always say I'm not the spokesperson of the African community. I'm not claiming that I have my finger on the pulse of everything. I'm just looking at data. Data suggests that African American Democrats are fairly moderate, fairly pragmatic. Yeah. Not on every single issue, but the can. I mean, this seems to be just a classic case of, you know, two African American candidates. One who has a record of trashing the Democratic establishment, and one having a record of saying, I'm going to work with the Democratic establishment, particularly Joe Biden, who's a very popular figure, that candidate's going to have the leg up in a race dominated by African-American voters.
Yeah. That analysis seems right to me. And yeah, I mean, if you pay too much attention to what people are saying on Twitter, then you can easily forget that sort of thing. I mean, I didn't follow this race closely, but I looked at the map, and this is clearly a very gerrymandered district that is like, it's not just Cleveland, it's also Akron. And so this must have been made for someone, essentially, you know, to I'm a majority minority district or something. And I assume that like some suburban white areas were cut out on purpose to basically make this a safe district for the Democrats, you know, back when, you know, Black Democrat equaled, you know, standard, like, rank and file would just go along with the party line kind of thing. And then, you know, I was thinking in these cases like AOC or some other ones, what often happens is that there is an outsider who is not white challenging an entrenched incumbent who is somewhat past their prime and isn't taking it seriously, who is white. And then so you are able to combine a sort of sick of this old person coalition with a minority, like sympathy for a minority candidate coalition and a leftist coalition. And but then when you have two black candidates running against each other, both of whom are newcomers, you don't get the, well, we're sick of this guy who's been there for 40 years, let's get some new blood in there. And you don't get the, like, people who are not white just voting for the non-white candidate out of, you know, racial sympathy. And so
I mean, I think the only cases of that, it's AOC beating Crowley and Bowman beating Engel.
Right. What about Tlaib and...
Tlaib was an open seat.
Okay.
That was Conyers' seat.
Right.
And I think Omar was Keith Ellison's seat. Yes. That was open. Mondaire Jones was an open seat. That was Nita Lowey's. And Cori Bush beat an African-American incumbent who they painted as too entrenched and too corporate. In St. Louis area. I think these are not irrelevant examples. I think it is true that in some of the deepest blue areas, and some of these are sort of deeply urban areas, and some of these are college-educated white suburban areas. Bowman's is some of both. It's got Bronx and Westchester. And Mondaire Jones is Northern Westchester. These are my old stomping grounds. I know that area, well. But otherwise, you got Detroit, you got Minneapolis, and you got St. Louis. So it's not like you can't do it, but certainly not across the board. You couldn't do it Cleveland, Akron. You couldn't do it for New York City writ large for mayor because Eric Adams was the most conservative candidate in that field. San Francisco, London Breed was considered more close to business than her progressive challengers, Mark Leno and Jane Kim. And then this is San Francisco. This is one of the most liberal places in the universe.
Yeah.
So it's not a slam dunk even in blue areas, and it certainly isn't a slam dunk in purple areas.
Yeah.
Now you can say, for example, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock were a few more ticks to the left than you might have expected a Democrat to be able to win in a place like Georgia that has been red for so long. So it's not like you have to be, a Joe Manchin, Simpson Bowles acolyte, to win in a purple area. But there's a difference between, being more to the left than you needed to be 20 years ago and being an outright Democratic socialist who is waging war against the Democratic establishment. There's a lot of room between those two places.
Yeah.
And what's weird about Ohio 11 is Nina Turner seemed to begin the race with an understanding of that and got some establishment endorsements locally. Got the mayor's endorsement. What wasn't replicating what you said about Joe Biden in 2020. Wasn't calling him a bowl of S, in the midst of this race.
What was Turner's background before she joined with Bernie?
I mean, she was a legislator. I mean, forgive me for not having her whole bio in front of me, but she had won elective office in the area before. So she's not.
So she's not an AOC like figure outsider to politics.
Correct. I mean, she had, she has knowledge of how elections are won in that area. But she seems torn between playing the traditional political game locally and wanting to be a movement leader. And so I really don't understand why you would ship in Bernie Sanders and AOC to win a local race. It's not like this was Bernie Central in 2020 or 2016. She had the ability to make this a local race. She began making it a local race. And then she pivoted away from that at a time when her opponent was gaining traction. So that math didn't add up for me. And the only thing that does add up for me is that I think for a lot of these people, building the movement's more important than winning the seat. They want to be associated with Bernie and AOC. They want to build a socialist movement, and they don't want to dilute that in any way.
Right.
If that means sacrificing a loss here and there, so be it.
Yeah, and, I mean, like, who really, you know, would you rather be a movement leader or would you rather be one of the 435 House members and on, like, the, you know, committee on, like, wetlands or something? Like, you know.
I honestly expect AOC to run for president because I don't think she wants to be the subcommittee chair 20 years from now. I don't think that's what her end goal in life is. She can go big or go home because going home is still being a movement leader.
Right. Well, you know, some people think the New York gubernatorial office will be an open seat in a couple years.
But
so
she probably would lose that.
Probably, yeah. But the thing is, she is also very charismatic and very smart. And, you know, she's had some missteps for someone who was a political novice. She's conducted herself, you know, pretty well, I think. I mean, another data point is this race in Buffalo for mayor, where it was where a black challenger who's an avowed socialist, as we used to say, defeated the incumbent black male mayor. And this was another one where probably the incumbent was like, well, I don't need to take this seriously. This person is a nobody.
He was asleep at the switch. And it was a low turnout race because it was a primary. But normally speaking, the Democratic primary is the de facto general.
Right.
This is how AOC beat Joe Crowley. Now, I don't know if you're aware, the incumbent mayor is running as a write-in.
Yes, that
in the generals.
Who knows what will happen with that? And yeah, that's hard to game out. And I assume that, you know, the mayor of Buffalo, New York, has plenty of sort of Tammany Hall style favors he can call in and play of constituencies he's assiduously, you know, paid attention to over the years of union endorsements or municipal employees, or that, not like a corrupt thing, but just like, you know, he has his supporters and they will come out and write his name down. So that
my understanding is, I mean, he's not without enemies. He's tangled with the city council there. But from what I can glean, and I actually have a friend who's a reporter there, I'll give you a little bit of a lowdown, that the general muckety mucks of Buffalo are not all that interested in having not just a socialist has never been in office before. You know, it's very rare that your community pillars want an amateur in the mayor's office.
They want an amateur who they think they can tell them what to do and they'll do it, not an amateur who says, I'm a socialist and I have all these ideas of how we're going to change everything up. So
I do think the incumbent mayor is going to have assets running as a write-in. I mean, write-ins can be tough things, but they can't
also
work.
His name is Brown. And so that's famously like when Lisa Murkowski, you know, was running in, like, the spelling of her name was part of the, you know, entire thing of where everyone can spell the name Brown, I assume. Have you paid any attention to what's been happening in Rochester politics over the past couple months?
I have not.
Well, so I used to live, I don't live there anymore. I used to live there, but there was a woman who still is the mayor, and I think she first won in 2012 or so. Her name is Lovely Warren. And she was rumored to possibly, so Robert Duffy, who was the mayor of Rochester, was Cuomo's lieutenant governor in the first one or two Cuomo administrations, maybe just the first one. And so that was sort of like bringing in the Western New York part of the coalition. And then Duffy went to run the Monroe County Chamber of Commerce or something or other. And so they picked Hochul instead. But there was some rumor that Lovely Warren would be picked to be Cuomo's lieutenant governor, you know, running mate. And that didn't happen. And then she has had like a complete political meltdown with some sort of local corruption kind of stuff, but also her ex-husband who she has a child with, or maybe they were never married, but they were living together. He was arrested for being part of a drug dealing organization and having guns in the house. And then she was arrested for child endangerment for guns in the house for a child. And so she is totally crashing down, and she lost her Democratic primary, but she maybe, because she was under indictment, she wouldn't have been able to serve as mayor anyway or something like that. So, and she was part of this, the local sort of Tammany Hall style leader was this guy, David Gant, who had been in the assembly for like 40 years, and she was a protege of him, and he died within the last 2 years. So that sort of whole, the whole like Rochester, you know, political world is falling apart and maybe new things will happen. But I think it's sort of an outsider type guy, another a black male candidate, won the primary for mayor, and will be, you know, I assume will become the next mayor. I don't know if there's a Republican running, but yeah, it's, you know, strange things happen out there in the cities of Western New York.
Well, before we wrap, I do want to touch base on infrastructure and maybe there's also this eviction issue, which I think is, you know, not directly connected, but it does speak to how far that the squad is willing to go and how much power do they have in this process. Because again, speaking to what's happening in these races, you know, I would argue that Solskjaer have not made nearly as many inroads in the party as they think or hoped. At the same time, here's Cori Bush having a big protest in front of Capitol Hill, drawing attention to the lapse of the eviction moratorium, and successfully pressured Biden into issuing a partial restoration of the moratorium, even though he's saying openly, I don't think it's going to pass muster in the courts. So it does show what kind of power these individual congresspeople can have. They have bully pulpits. They can draw media attention. They can channel left energy. It's much less clear how that translates into the business of legislating, because we haven't seen squad be able to throw their weight around in that venue. AOC is trying. So we have a bipartisan deal that's almost at fruition. You know, they're still crossing the T's, but it would seem like they're going to get there in the Senate after passing the initial cloture votes. You have AOC saying the House shouldn't pass this unless reconciliation is passed first, that that's banked before we get to the bipartisan thing, which they don't even like. And Pelosi sounds on the same page as that, although I do think Pelosi's wording has wiggle room. But AOC was on CNN this Sunday saying, you know, we have the votes to deny passage to the bipartisan deal. Although she didn't say precisely how many votes that meant. She said double digits. And she said,
that's if they don't pair it with the reconciliation thing, which correct. Is sort of like more of a liberal leftist wish list kind of
correct.
Stuff.
Correct. Although again, what's funny about this is that we don't even know what's going to be in that bill. Cause that's not, that cake's not baked. There are top line numbers. There's rough sketches, but we know Kyrsten Sinema is saying, I'm not going to do $3.5 trillion. Clearly there's more negotiating to be done there. We're knowing what even is even in that bill. Yet you have folks saying until this amorphous bill is passed, we're not going to deal with this existing bill. That's almost.
Yeah. It seems too clever, too complicated, too cute or something to do that. I don't know. I mean, what's interesting to me, and this sort of is what gets also to the thing I wanted to ask you about if you were to come on my show and talk about your other podcast, is sort of like, you know, is pragmatic America, can we return to that? Is that like a dream from the past of like everyone rolling up their sleeves and working out some sort of half a loaf style agreement and like accomplishing things that make America better? Or is it all like people fighting and, you know, picking a fight so they get on TV, that sort of stuff? And so what happened with the infrastructure bill is sort of like a throwback to a previous generation of legislating where like they are in the room, they are hammering out these details, they do seem to all care, they do want to get something passed, everyone is compromising. So that's sort of like classic, you know, American civics stuff. And if it passes, then that will be, I guess, a positive sign that like the system is still working in some ways. But on the other side, we had Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell, and they were, you know, they were not pragmatists.
I'll say this though. There were even bipartisan things that passed under Trump. They passed criminal justice reform. They did. Right. They did do pandemic relief in a very big way. I mean, there's a bona fide crisis.
Like a voice vote to begin with. Did you see, I think Matt Iglesias coined this term, the secret Congress. It's like there's things that are happening that people are arguing about on cable news and on Twitter. At the same time, like, there's sort of like normal things are happening underneath, and because no one's paying attention to it, they just sort of do get done.
Well, and before Matt Iglesias, there was a guy named Bill Scheer who wrote at the end of the Obama presidency that he had a big bipartisan legacy that nobody wanted to call attention to because no one wanted to take credit for the bipartisan things that happened. They would do it, and then they would still yell about it or ignore it. So I think that's been going on for some time. I mean, the level of polarization is such that it's not cleanly politically advantageous to wear your bipartisanship on your lapel. What's different about the infrastructure deal is this is the first thing that's happened where people are actually advertising it and trying to take credit for it. And Biden's trying to take credit for it as being a bipartisan thing. Look, we can do things again. But we should keep in mind that it's tenuous, it's limited, and part of the deal is that if there wasn't the threat of reconciliation as an ability for Democrats to do something even bigger, there may not have been enough pressure on Republicans to do this much. So it's not like it's automatically going to lead to a paradigm shift. This might be as much as we can do pragmatically in this Congress, and then we'll have to see what the numbers are in the next Congress.
I mean, I haven't, you've been following this very closely, and some of the stuff that you've talked about on the show or have retweeted, I've been following, but I haven't been following it closely myself. But like, you know, repairing roads and bridges, that's like the most basic thing that seemingly everyone can agree to, is like, yes, the bridges should not collapse. You know, the roads need to be maintained. And then you have stuff like rural broadband or, you know, replacing lead pipes, where it's almost like, yes, if you can't get behind this, you know, what are we doing here? And then, but then you move to more like, well, how are we paying for this? And could this possibly be raising taxes or at all? Are we sort of being fuzzy about, you know, we're going to increase IRS, you know, empower the IRS to go after tax cheats more. So that's where the money's coming from. That's
which they couldn't, which they couldn't do. They had to back off of that.
Yeah, even Grover Norquist got mad. At this point, it's like, this is almost like gravy kind of like stuff of like, yeah, who wouldn't, you know, who wouldn't want the roads to be improved or the lead pipes to be removed? But then once you get to things where it's like, well, maybe there actually are some losers when it comes to this, or things that people oppose ideologically, like making the child tax credit permanent. You know, Mickey Kouse is one such person on Blogging Heads has been talking a lot about opposing that sort of thing. Then can some sort of practical deal be cut? Or yeah, it's just like, you know, public improvements is like, you know, the thing Congress has been doing for a very long time, and we can just barely get that done now.
I mean, in one sense, yes, it has been a source of bipartisanship in the past. But if you look back, I did a piece about this at the Washington Monthly. Infrastructure bills have been hard fought. They've taken a lot longer to come together right. than this one. This is actually like record time. People get, and there's often knockdown dragouts in terms of how you're going to pay for it and what the size and the scope are going to be. So these are very normal tensions that have occurred. And, you know, it takes effort and trust and persistence and diligence to power through them, which they seem to have done here. So to circle back to AOC's power play, you know, what she said to CNN seemed premised on the notion that what was going to go through the House was going to pass on a party line vote, because she mentioned that the margin was only 3 and that she had the numbers beyond that. But if some Republicans are voting for this, as Republicans seem to be prepared to do in the Senate, then that makes AOC's job harder to exercise leverage. You know, you have 29 Republicans in the Problem Solvers Caucus, which have already expressed support for something like the Senate bill. They haven't come out and, you know, I think, fully supported just yet, but they seem very much in play. If all 29 were on board, now you need 33 Democrats willing to walk before killing this. And if the bipartisan bill is ready, it's passed the Senate, and you have House moderates who are vulnerable in the midterm openly saying, as some already have begun to say, we need to do this first. We can't wait. My constituents want this. Hey, Speaker Pelosi, I need this. I need this to win my race. Mm-hmm. Pelosi, Pelosi has rattled some sabers here, but she also has a history of climbing down from the ladder in service of vulnerable moderates who need protection. I can't predict. I'm not going to say, put it in the bank that she's going to flip flop on this, but it would not be surprising if Pelosi is someone who counts the votes.
Yes.
If she has the votes, if she has enough Democratic and Republican votes that she can move without AOC's permission, I would think she would, because you get the bill passed, you get it to Biden's desk, and you say to AOC, what are you going to do? Kill the reconciliation bill?
Yeah. And it's such a this is not the sort of thing that normal people pay attention to. And so if there's some person who's, running for re-election, they're like, well, I voted against this because the reconciliation bill, blah, blah. It's just like way too complicated. It doesn't make sense to a normal person. It's like, yeah, I supported it, but I voted against it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, what this makes me think of is, like, the squad is trying to sort of pull the same stunt or strategy that the House Freedom Caucus once did, but it's a different situation because the House Freedom Caucus is like 30 or so members. The squad is like 7. And the GOP is different because they're fine sort of, blowing the whole thing up and just yelling about it on Fox News afterwards. Whereas like a lot of Democratic legislators actually do want to pay for the improvement of roads and bridges and so forth. And they're like there for, I think, a reason that they have actual like constituencies they need to satisfy. Whereas it's sort of easier to sort of be a GOP House member and ride to continual reelection by, acting kooky and getting on Fox News and that sort of thing. So
that's why I think a lot of Democrats misread the landscape, because they thought Republicans were going to be obstructionist to the maximum degree. They're going to jerk your chain. They're going to waste your time. And so, and Manchin, Sinema, they're going to see that. They're going to see it's a waste of time. So just try to shoot the moon and wait for all the pieces to come together. And I think that misread that there are genuine incentives for Republicans to cooperate here, partly bringing home goodies to their own constituencies, and partly to scrub off some of that obstructionist reputation. They want to be able to say, hey, I'm a reasonable guy. I'm Mitch McConnell. I'm reasonable. I'm not the Prince of Darkness.
What does McConnell ultimately want to accomplish? And he's like 79 or 80. What is his legacy? What do you want his legacy to be? Who knows? So, he obviously decided it was in his interest and his caucus's interest to let some people vote for this.
Well, yeah. He wants to obstruct most things.
Right.
He wants to have the credibility to do that. So he's providing genuine political cover for his people so they can obstruct things without getting in trouble back home for those in the more purple areas. And they also are very worried that if they were too difficult, that they would lose Manchin and Sinema, and they would go whole hog in reconciliation or even scale back the filibuster. So, there is value in Democrats threatening to abolish the filibuster. But this, is, in my opinion, is a classic, the threat is stronger than the execution kind of play. Mm-hmm. Because if you actually pull the trigger on it, well, then Republicans can use it in full force when they get the opportunity. If it's threatened but not executed, you can make Republicans do more than they might have done otherwise. And I think that's where we are today.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I just wanted to make a point, getting back to the eviction moratorium and Cori Bush. I feel like if this was 2010 and Obama was president and this was playing out, the message would have been like, well, we don't think this is going to pass muster in the court, so it's not even worth trying it. And they would have brought out a law professor or Timothy Geithner or something to explain to everyone, like, our internal assessment is that this isn't going to work, and so we're not going to try it, and this is wrong, so what's the point of trying it? And people would have been like, okay, well, the smart people are saying this isn't going to work, so let's just try it. I think something has changed, whereas like some amount of left pressure has meant that, like, oh, and sort of like Trump showing that you can do whatever the hell you want, and it'll at least keep the ball in the air for some amount of time, such that they're like, okay, let's say 60 more days, maybe the court will strike this down. At least then we'll be able to say we fought for it and tried, and not like the smart people decided that this is the right course. And so you know, people out there in the electorate have to accept this, what the smart people said is true. There does seem to be a shift to me that they're at least listening to a more populist voice or more populist energy from their base, instead of thinking like, just, you know, sort of like a mistake I think Obama made early on, where he was like, okay, let's let the technocrats and the wonks and the experts solve this thing, instead of, you know, trying to gin up some sort of like populist outrage and do stunts like Cori Bush's thing and so forth.
I mean, there were tensions there. I mean, there definitely was progressive activist pressure on the Obama administration to do more on foreclosures. They wanted to do like, you know, a cram down mortgage policy to you know, force reduced interest rates. And they lost a lot of those battles, you know, with Tim Geithner, with Obama. And I think Obama proved to be a tough nut to crack, because he had a lot of goodwill in the Democratic base. You did see more blood drawn in the second term. I mean, not so much on housing, but, you know, Elizabeth Warren was able to deny, you know, a Treasury appointment that Obama wanted for undersecretary. And TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, they scotched that whole trade deal. So, you know,
maybe DACA is sort of somewhat similar, where it's like, they thought they weren't sure this is going to work, but they decided to do it anyway, and it's still being fought out in the court. So it wasn't like a, you know, play it safe, only slam dunks kind of thing. You know, they're like, let's try to solve this problem, and we may do it in a way that is ultimately rejected by the courts or something, but, you know, we're trying it. We're not just like, let the experts decide this one.
But there was a lot of patience with immigrant activists, because, you know, they didn't get anything passed in the first term. They were frustrated by the deportations, and there was complaints about that, but it never really boiled over. And they accepted in the Senate immigration bill a massive line item for border security in exchange for getting a pathway to citizenship. And then when that fell apart, they feel like that wasn't worth it, and they're much more reluctant to engage in that kind of horse trading right now. And so Obama went to the DACA route only after every other avenue was exhausted in the middle of the second term. And now there's, by the time, very difficulty piecing together a coalition for legislation that would last beyond an executive order. So, I mean, I think you're right that the progressive activists are more willing to be provocative earlier on in this administration, in the previous administration. But at the same time, it's not Democrats in disarray.
Right.
There's still a lot of unity. They're still working within, I think, reasonable parameters, where, you know, it isn't blood on the floor. It isn't undermining Biden's general popularity. And they don't feel like Biden is, you know, fundamentally working across purposes with them on the bigger items.
Yeah. And Biden has been, you know, surprisingly, I don't know how you would characterize it, like, there have been left or populist, like, strong reactions to a decision he's made, and he's been willing to change course. And things with immigration and this thing with the moratorium, like, he can be pressured.
He can be pressured.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but he's not.
He has those release valves. You know, because
so he like sort of will dole out some victories or something, or he's sensitive to some pressure from the more activist left in a way that it surprises me somewhat, but I mean, he's been a politician for,
but there's still 47
years, like, or whatever. So he knows how to operate these things.
He's not doing that on canceling student loan debt, but he did do it on jacking up the number of refugees they're going to admit. So
yeah, right. I mean, that's a pretty simple, you know, that there's no real loser in the refugee cap kind of thing. Like, that's an easy decision.
Well, I mean, these are things where I think Biden has been around long enough to know that you can overreach. There can be backlash. We had it with Jimmy Carter. We had it with Bill Clinton. We had it with Barack Obama and Donald Trump. There is a way that you can give into the base too much and get people angry at the local level. I mean, Bill Clinton as a governor was pummeled on a refugee issue because Carter let in, you know, Cuban refugees, and it made the locals in Arkansas very upset. So these things are not without potential costs. And I think Biden is sensitive to that. So, but he also is aware that you can't just say no all the time, or else you're going to have Democrats in disarray. So he's trying to walk that line and give a little here and withhold there. And so far it's holding together, but, I mean, I guess I'll quote from Mondaire Jones, saying that this can't hold on in perpetuity, that after reconciliation is done, that if they can't get voting rights, passed, that's going to be a far bigger problem for the party. And that is a very hard issue that you can't do the reconciliation, and they're not going to abolish the filibuster over it. So, I mean, I think people should follow my counsel and start again, don't assume that Republicans are fully obstructionist. Look under the surface and think about where there might be avenues of opportunity. I think there are those avenues in voting rights, but you got to get out of your pre-cooked narratives. Right now, no one's willing to do that.
Yeah, you've been beating the drum on this for a while, and there's definitely, I see people on Twitter who are like, you know, Biden is giving up on democracy because, yeah, they're not going to kill the filibuster over the voting rights thing. And that's overly simplistic in the least. And yeah, as you've noted, like, you know, these things are not so simple. Like, this, it will benefit the Democrats and not the Republicans. There's plenty of people who are former felons who are potential Trump type voters, you know, non-college educated white men, who, if they had their rights given back to them, which should be done, in my opinion, just as because everyone should have the right to vote, this is not like a gift to the Democrats. Like, it might just be a wash in the end, but still being the right thing to do.
And that's the only way to get that. The only way to get that kind of bill passed is to convince everybody that it's not going to put your thumb on the scale. And we've gone a long time, so we probably should wrap it up. Anything you want to plug to the DMZers out there who are otherwise familiar with your work?
Right. So podcast is culturally determined. If you subscribe to the Blog Edge feed, you get it already. You can also just subscribe to it on your own feed, culturally determined once again. Twitter, ARYHCW. You know, I'll announce it here. I'm a very soft launch because I'm not actually sure if I'll be able to finish this week. I'm going to try doing a Substack, which is like, I'm like late to the game. And I swore I would not do it Substack because I'm too lazy. But I realized what I would want to do is just a links, like a weekly links roundup, a sort of old school blog thing where just like, here's interesting articles I read this week or in the past 2 weeks or something that I think are worthwhile, you know, a sentence or two about each one. And so I'm going to try doing that. So rehcw.substack.com. It doesn't even exist right now, but maybe within a few days I'll put something out. So if you want to subscribe to that, you can do so there.
Excellent. And I do have a piece at the Monthly this week about the challenges for the expanded child tax credit. We didn't get to talk about that here. I did talk about it on the Politics podcast, which should be up today. So if you want to hear that interview that I did, you should check that out and check out the piece of the Monthly. And it was great to talk to you. And I'll have to go bone up on my Hannah Arendt if I'm going to get onto your podcast. But you let me know.
Yeah, so we didn't go fully into all the stuff that I was thinking of asking you. If you come on mine, so hopefully, and especially when your history podcast really gets rolling, you can come on mine and we can talk more history stuff and not, you know, the grubby politics of 2021 and all that stuff, but have a more historical view of important events that history has maybe forgotten somewhat. So thanks for having me on. It's a dream come true. I finally appeared on the DMZ.
Excellent. Great to talk to you. And I believe Matt will be back here at the DMZ next week. And talk to you all then. Take care.
Later.